Everyone likes to hear a good story well told. We Bible students especially appreciate the lessons taught in the scriptural accounts of characters in the Old and New Testaments. These accounts are stories, not in the sense that they are fables, but in the sense that they are true histories of the lives of those Bible characters. And so I call them Bible stories in that sense of the word. What is your favorite Bible story? If a child came to you and said, "Tell me a Bible story," which one would be the first to come to your mind? Would it be the bravery of David when he faced Goliath, or the wisdom and courage of Esther as she saved her people at the risk of her own life? Perhaps the love story of Mary, who anointed the feet of her beloved Jesus. There are too many favorites, perhaps, to have just one. So the best we can do is have a list of 10 or 20 or 30 of our favorite Bible stories. On my list, fairly near the top, perhaps at the very top, would be a story that might not even be on your list at all. It's the story of Naaman the leper, sometimes called the story of Naaman the Syrian. Today I'll tell you the story of Naaman the leper, first, in the brief form, as you would tell it to a child. Then we'll read the account, verse by verse, in 2 Kings chapter 5, and examine the details of the story. There won't be any pictures on a screen today, because while illustrations are useful in a discourse on a technical subject, they can be a little distracting in a talk like this, where the pictures in your imagination will be the most helpful to bringing the lessons to life in your own mind. On a very basic level, the story of Naaman the leper would be told to a child like this. Naaman was a mighty general in the army of Syria, and he had leprosy, a disease that rots away your flesh and ultimately kills you. It's very contagious, so that no one dares to even touch anyone who has leprosy. The king of Syria sent his friend Naaman to Israel to see if the prophet Elisha could cure Naaman the leper and save his life. Naaman came to Elisha and was told to wash himself 7 times in the river Jordan. Naaman did as Elisha told him, and his leprosy was healed. Now there are 2 lessons in this story. You would continue to the child to whom you are telling it. The first is a lesson of faith. Naaman had faith in God, and his faith was rewarded. The second lesson is a symbolic lesson about the coming kingdom of God. In this symbolic lesson, Naaman pictures the world of mankind, and Naaman's leprosy pictures the disease of sin and death that afflicts all mankind. When Naaman bathed in the river Jordan and his leprosy was healed, that pictured how in the kingdom all mankind will be resurrected and healed from their sin and death. So that's the simple story of Naaman the leper and the 2 basic lessons as you would explain them to a child. Now let's take a much closer look at the details of the account. The story of Naaman the leper is told in 2 Kings chapter 5. You can turn your Bibles there because we'll be in that chapter for the entire discourse, except for one time when we'll turn to the New Testament. 2 Kings chapter 5. We're going to read the entire chapter a few verses at a time, and we'll begin with verse 1, 2 Kings 5:1. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. This introductory first verse tells us 4 things about Naaman. First, he was the captain of all the armies of Syria, their general, their commander-in-chief, and he was a brave leader, a mighty man of valor. Second, he was loved and highly respected by the king of Syria. Third, Jehovah God gave Naaman a victory over Syria's enemies because Naaman was an honorable man, a good man. And fourth, he had leprosy. Now, leprosy was a terrible disease. It manifested itself as whitish sores on the face and all over the body. The nerve endings close to the skin were attacked and deadened so that all movement and feeling were lost in the hands and in the feet and in the arms and in the legs. The disease was contagious and always resulted in a premature death. Leprosy is a fitting symbol of sin, which also results in a deadening of the moral senses and leads to death. I said leprosy was a terrible disease, past tense. Leprosy is now called Hansen's disease because the bacterium which causes leprosy was identified by a Norwegian doctor named G. Armauer Hansen. And today there are antibiotics which can completely control this once dreaded disease. Oh, and the year in which Dr. Hansen discovered and identified the bacterium which causes leprosy, leading to its control and cure, was 1874. Now let's read verses 2 to 4 of 2 Kings 5. And the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she, the little maid, said unto her mistress, Would God, my lord Naaman, were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy. And one went in and told his lord, saying, Thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel. Now these are, to my mind, some of the most interesting verses in this account, because they quickly introduce and then just as quickly remove the most fascinating character in the whole story. Not Naaman, not even Elisha, but a young woman whose name is not even given. You know, I almost titled this discourse, The Little Maid, because she is the real heroine of this story, as much as or even more so than Naaman himself. I'll explain why in a moment. But first, picture in your mind a movie about the story of Naaman the leper. The movie portrays raids by small bands of Syrian soldiers upon the outlying farms and villages of Israel. The marauding Syrians sneak up on their victims, steal their food, and take the people captive back to Damascus, the capital of Syria, to work as slaves. Among these captives taken in one of these raids is a little girl, a little maid, a teenager. She shows some intelligence and talent, so she is given the better job of waiting on Naaman's wife, fetching water, helping her dress, running errands, and so forth. And, we can surmise, she was probably treated kindly in the house of Naaman, because Naaman was a good man. Now, most teenage girls, taken away from their homes and families to work as a servant girl in a strange land for a strange family, even if they were treated kindly, would most likely be rather sullen and bitter at their lot in life. Upon finding out that the master of the house had the dread disease of leprosy, most ordinary teenage girls might secretly be gleeful. Most teenage girls would think quietly to themselves, Good, I hope your arms and legs rot off. I hate you. But this little maid, whose name we don't even know, was not like most teenage girls. She was sensitive to Naaman's plight and said to Naaman's wife, If only your husband were in my home country where we worship the true God, there is a prophet there who would cure him of his leprosy. What maturity, what empathy. But even that is not at all why I think this little maid is the real heroine of the story. The reason I think the little maid is the real heroine of the story is because it was the shining example of her faith in God that created faith in Naaman. Now, Naaman was an experienced man, a world traveler, a mighty general, highly intelligent and gifted. He was not one to believe fairy tales told by little girls from a foreign country. Yet it was on the urgent word of this teenage girl that Naaman undertook the long journey to Israel in faith and in confidence and was cured. The lesson of the story, as I said before, is to have faith like Naaman's. If your faith is like Naaman's, good. But if your faith is like the little maid's, bringing forth in others a similar faith, better. And the faith of the little maid is all the more remarkable when we realize that Elisha had never, to that date, cured anyone of leprosy. How could the little maid be so confident in something she had never seen happen? We'll talk more about that later as well. But the initial lesson of this story is, may the witness of your faith be not only like that of Naaman's, but even more, like that of the little maid with whom you have to do in the daily affairs of your life. Let's continue on with the Bible account. 2 Kings 5, 5 through 8. And the king of Syria said, Go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he, Naaman, departed, and took with him 10 talents of silver, and 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, Now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy. And it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that, in private now, out of Naaman's hearing, he rent his clothes and said, Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me. And it was so when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent unto the king, saying, Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him, Naaman, come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. Now in Old Testament times, matters such as this would have been managed at the highest levels, at the level of the head of state. So the king of Syria, who, as we said before, loved and respected his good friend Naaman, sent a formal request in writing with him to the king of Israel, whose name was most likely Jehoram, we get from the context of previous chapters, along with gifts of gold, silver, and raiment, and asked respectfully for the king of Israel to arrange for the healing of the beloved Naaman of his leprosy. The king of Syria no doubt reasoned that such a man who could cure leprosy would be well known unto the king of Israel, probably even a member of the king's innermost circle of advisors and ministers. Well, the king of Syria guessed wrong. As we read, the king of Israel responded badly. First, the king of Israel was apparently unaware or couldn't figure out that it was Elisha, the prophet, whose services were being requested. Apparently, the king of Israel thought he himself was expected to cure Naaman of his leprosy. Second, the king of Israel interprets the request by the king of Syria as a pretense to declare war, when the king of Israel would be unable to fulfill the request of healing Naaman and thus offend the king of Syria for turning him down. And so the king of Israel excuses himself from Naaman's presence and hastily calls his advisors together for a private meeting, where he rends his clothes as a sign of extreme anguish. What should I do? He asks his counselors. You see the dilemma I'm in. Now Elisha was told all of what happened when Naaman presented himself to Jehoram and how Jehoram reacted and rent his clothes. So Elisha sent a messenger to the king to calm him down and reassure him. Why did you rend your clothes? Send Naaman to me, Elisha tells Jehoram through his messenger, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. And I may be reading a little bit of unfounded sarcasm into Elisha's message here, but I think Elisha's implication was, and you too, O king of Israel, will also know that there is a prophet in Israel right here in your own backyard. Doubtless King Jehoram was greatly relieved to have this dilemma off his hands, So he regains his kingly composure, puts on some new clothes because his old bones are torn in pieces, straightens out his crown and goes to see Naaman and tells him, go to Elisha, who will take care of your request. The story continues in 2 Kings 5, 9 to 14. So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean. But Naaman was wroth, and went away, and said, behold, I thought he will surely come out to me, and stand, and call upon the name of the Lord his God, and strike his hand over the place, and recover the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. And his servants came near and spake unto him and said, my father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith to thee, wash and be clean? Then went he down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. If, as I said, I think the little maid is the most fascinating character in this story, I think these verses are the most moving. I hope I can get through my retelling of them without tears coming to my eyes. And I hope that when the movie version of this account is finally made in the kingdom, that I get to help write the screenplay. Although they'll have Naaman and Elisha there, and they can probably do a much better job than myself. Naaman comes to Elisha's house, probably a humble dwelling, far less than what Naaman was expecting for a powerful, holy man who could cure leprosy. Naaman stands outside the door, respectfully and patiently waits for the great Elisha to receive him. Presently, Elisha's assistant, probably named Gehazi, comes to the door with instructions for Naaman. Go to the Jordan River and wash or submerge yourself 7 times, and your leprosy will be healed. Now it's Naaman's turn to react curiously. He's angry. He's angry for 2 reasons. First, he says, I expected Elisha to come out here and put on a show. I expected him to call upon his God and wave his arms up and down and say the magic words of Shazam, I would be healed from my leprosy. Back home in Syria, Naaman probably saw many such showy displays by the false gods of Rimmon. Doubtless the priests of Rimmon had prayed to their false god on Naaman's behalf several times that his leprosy might be healed, all to no avail. So Naaman probably thought this is how all religious men do their work. With a great show, in order to impress the people. The second, Naaman says in verse 12, why should I wash in the Jordan Creek? To Naaman, the Jordan was just a little creek. There are much larger and mightier rivers back where I came from, much more fitting to be the setting for this great miracle of healing. So Naaman turns around and walks away in a rage. His faith was still strong. Naaman's faith was not in question. But he's greatly displeased at the instructions he's been given. You know, it seems that all the great heroes of the Old Testament have some sort of flaw. Abraham lied twice about Sarah being his wife. He said, she is my sister. Moses smote the rock instead of speaking to it, and so was denied entrance into the promised land. David yielded to his lust for Bathsheba. Because the scriptures include the account of even these flaws of those heroes of faith, we know that the Bible is a true record of God's word and not mere fables about impossibly perfect people developed and devised by conniving men. And there is always a lesson for us in the flaws of these heroes as well as in their triumphs. What do you suppose might be the lesson for us in this flaw of Naaman's? Perhaps it is this. At the beginning of the harvest of the gospel age, Christians coming out of the nominal systems into the truth were like Naaman coming out of Syria to Elisha. Christians in the nominal churches were accustomed to worship services being a great show with ornate buildings and costumes and elaborate ceremonies, a great show like Naaman had seen in the house of Rimmon. So perhaps a few, not many we think, of those coming out of Babylon in the early days of the gospel harvest were a little put off by the lack of pomp and circumstance among the brethren, the Bible students, with whom they had come to associate. They expected to see the same show they were used to. Instead, God's instructions to all Christians, like Elisha's to Naaman, were simple but effective in cleansing them from sin. Worship God in spirit and in truth. Believe in the ransom merit of Jesus' blood and consecrate yourself to sacrifice. Simple instructions. Today, at this end of the gospel age harvest, that lack of show would not stumble any of us who are several generations removed from the nominal churches and their ceremonies. But I think there is still a similar lesson even for us here and now. Naaman basically complained that his expectations were not being met by the instructions he was given. The style of the worship services and the arrangement for his healing from leprosy were not meeting his needs. Or so Naaman thought. In fact, everything was arranged to meet Naaman's needs. Naaman confused his needs with his wants. He needed to be healed from leprosy, but he wanted his healing done in a manner to his liking. And here's the lesson. Isn't it perhaps so sometimes with us? What we truly need is to be cleansed, justified, sanctified, developed into a Christ-like character. But sometimes we want our character development to be done in a manner according to our liking, the way we want it at our jobs, in our homes, with our ecclesia, in our lives. Our faith is always still strong. Our faith is not in question. But sometimes we might be rather displeased with our experiences, our trials, our testings, our development, our situation, and we come this close, as Naaman did, to turning away, if not in a rage, at least in self-willed stubbornness. I want my life, my consecration to be my. Fortunately for Naaman, he listened to those around him who loved him. They were his servants and his fellow soldiers, but they addressed him as father in verse 13. My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? In other words, if Elisha told you to walk 100 miles through the desert with no food and only a little water, and then climb to the top of a rocky, jagged mountain and sit there in meditation and prayer for 7 days, and then build a stone altar 10 feet tall all by yourself and offer a sacrifice to be healed of your leprosy, wouldn't you have done every bit of it? Naaman knew the answer was yes. And so the logic of the servants who loved him was compelling. How reasonable it was to do as Elisha directed and wash in the Jordan 7 times. The lesson for us, I'd like to suggest, is that submissiveness to God's will and not our own preference is essential to our sanctification. Not my will, but thy will, O Lord, be done. How wise are God's commands, how sure his precepts are, as we sang in our opening hymn. Now comes the best part of the whole story. Naaman goes to the River Jordan, and in the movie version of this that I like to picture in my mind, you see a silent procession travel to the bank of the river. Naaman, calm now, his faith still as strong as it always has been, takes off his garments and slowly wades into the river by himself, the water up to his chest. His servants, unsure of what will happen, watch with some anxiety as Naaman immerses himself into the water. He rises up, and his servants strain to see any improvement in the leprosy on his face and his shoulders and on his arms. But there is none. A second time, Naaman immerses himself and rises up out of the water. Still no improvement. Again, the third, fourth, fifth, sixth time with the same result. This isn't working. The leprosy is not being healed. The servants glance nervously at each other and whisper about what is happening. Naaman pauses for a moment and then lowers himself into the water the seventh and last time. He seems to be beneath the water for a long time, but then the top of his head appears above the surface. Next, his face and shoulders completely clean of the dread disease. His flesh, like that of a child, Naaman looks at his hands and arms, beaming. The servants cannot contain themselves. They run, shouting and splashing into the river, and throw themselves on Naaman, embracing him and kissing him, almost knocking him over in their joy. After a few moments, Naaman pushes them gently away and with a look of resolve on his face says, "We must return to Elisha." In my little dramatization there, I said that the first six washings had no effect on Naaman and that the seventh removed all of the leprosy. The scriptures don't say that that's how it happened, but I think such is a reasonable conclusion from the kingdom picture I mentioned before, which is the symbolic lesson of this story. Naaman's leprosy pictures mankind's disease of sin and death, which will be cleansed in the kingdom, cleansed entirely within the 7,000-year day, after 6,000 years of no improvement from the curse of sin and death. The account continues in 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 15 to 19. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him. And he said, "Behold, now I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant." In other words, you know, take the gold and the silver and the clothes that I brought with me to pay you, to recompensate you for healing my leprosy. But he, Elijah, said, "As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he, Naaman, urged him to take it, but he, Elisha, refused. And Naaman said, "Shall there not, then, I pray thee, be given to thy servant, me, Naaman, 2 mules burden of earth? For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. In this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaneth on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing." And he, Elisha, said unto him, "Naaman, go in peace." So he departed from him a little way. Naaman offers Elisha the silver and golden raiment he had brought with him as payment for his healing. Again, such payment to priests and prophets was probably the custom in Naaman's homeland of Syria. And following our application earlier, payment to priests for prayers and other services was and still is the custom in the nominal church systems of our day. Elisha, of course, refuses all of Naaman's repeated urgent offers of payment, just as we minister the cleansing truth of God's plan to all who will receive it, without any material reimbursement or expectation of self-aggrandizement as a result of our ministering to the truth. And then Naaman asks Elisha something a little strange. He asks Elisha if Naaman could take back to Syria as much dirt from Elisha's front yard as 2 mules could carry. Naaman wants to bring back to his homeland enough of the soil of Israel to spread in Naaman's own front yard for a holy place to worship the true God, as if he were standing in Israel, where the true God of Jehovah was worshipped by the people. Naaman vows to Elisha that henceforth Naaman will worship only the true God, Jehovah. So what is the lesson in this for us? Well, brethren, don't we also carry in our hearts the memories of times and places where God led us and blessed us, maybe to the extent metaphorically in our lives of the healing of Naaman of his leprosy? And don't we also have special places in our hearts, little altars of remembrance, Ebenezers, where we go to praise and pray, where we go to reflect and be refreshed at what the Lord has done for us in the past? Verse 18 is especially meaningful. Again, in the movie version that plays in my mind, I see Naaman with his entourage ready to depart, the mules loaded down with the soil of Israel. Naaman has said his goodbyes. He has 1 foot out the door. And then there's something troubling. There's something that's been bothering him. He has a troubled look on his face. He's not sure if he should even bring this up, but he does. Naaman stammers, Elisha, there's one more thing. I now know there is but one God, Jehovah, and I will worship only him. But when my king goes into the temple of Rimmon to pray, he's old, and he takes my arm for support because we're such good friends. And when the king bows down before Rimmon, I cannot remain standing upright. If I don't also bow when the king bows, it will be disrespectful to my king. And so I would like to bow myself when the king bows. In my heart, I'm not bowing to Rimmon, but rather I'm bowing in respect to my friend, the king. Would that be okay? Naaman asked. Could I be pardoned for this? In the mental picture I have of this scene, it's a flashback to earlier times in Damascus, the capital of Syria, where we see a huge, magnificent temple to Rimmon with a long marble stairway up to a gilded sanctuary wherein stands the jewel-encrusted statue of Rimmon. The king, somewhat old but still regal and majestic, climbs the stairs slowly with his friend Naaman at his side. Naaman, his arm covered with robes to prevent the spread of his leprosy, supports the king as he ascends the stairs. They bow in unison as they enter, they bow in unison as they pray, and they bow in unison as they leave. But that was back then, before Naaman was healed. This is now. What should Naaman do when he returns to Damascus? He knows that it's wrong to bow down before the false god Rimmon anymore, but he doesn't want to offend his friend the king. Elisha tells Naaman, it's all right. Continue to do as you have done when you get back home for your friend the king's sake. Be at peace in your heart about this. What do you suppose might be the lesson for us in this exchange between Naaman and Elisha? Perhaps it's this. I'll make a suggestion, but you can judge for yourselves. In my own experience, about every 5 or 10 years or so, I find myself sitting in the back of a Catholic church at the wedding of one of my cousin's children or at the funeral of one of my aunts and uncles. And I feel uncomfortable just being there. When everyone else does the standing and the kneeling and the repeating of the words, it makes me uncomfortable. I sometimes even wonder if I'm doing wrong just sitting there in that building. And I know some of you perhaps have a similar discomfort. Perhaps the message for us who are so conflicted in Elisha's reply to Naaman is that if your heart is pure, your presence, even in an unholy place, will not corrupt you. If for the sake of others, you find it reasonably necessary to be there so as not to offend them and to show them reasonable respect, then, as Elisha said to Naaman, go in peace. Don't be troubled about it. And so Naaman departs for home. The story continues with a lesson about Elisha's servant Gehazi, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, I want to turn to the one scripture in the New Testament regarding Naaman. Keep your fingers in 2 Kings 5, because we'll come back there, and turn to Luke chapter 4. In Luke chapter 4 is the account of Jesus, after having performed miracles of healing in Capernaum, comes to Nazareth, his home, so to speak. And the people of Nazareth say to him, "How about us? We're your neighbors, your homeboys. Perform miracles and healings for us like you did for those strangers in Capernaum." Jesus answers this request for favors in Luke 4:24-28. "And he," Jesus said, "verily I say unto you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you of a truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elisha, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout all the land. But unto none of them was Elias sent, save unto Sarepta," or Zarephath, as it's rendered in the Old Testament, "a city of Sidon, unto a woman that was a widow." And here's the part. "And many lepers were in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed." None of them was cleansed, saving Naaman the Syrian. "And all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath." Jesus' point was, if there are none with faith to be found where there ought to be, as when it was Elijah, not Elisha, sent to the widow of Zarephath, and Elisha, who healed Naaman, if there are none with faith to be found where there ought to be in Israel, God will find faith elsewhere. There were many Hebrew lepers in Israel, but he, Elisha, healed none of them, because they kept not the law and the faith of their fathers. Only Naaman, a heathen who knew not Jehovah until his cleansing, was cured. Likewise, the Jews in Jesus' day said proudly, "We are Abraham's seed. We are a nation of God's chosen people. For that reason alone, we are entitled to receive his blessings." But Jesus reminded them, as Elisha did in his day, that simple collective heritage as God's people is not enough, and God's blessings pass them by. Each must make his faith his own individually and live his faith, demonstrate his faith daily. So it is with us. We are blessed to have the Bible student heritage of the truth that we do possess, and it's a wonderful blessing indeed. But it is not enough to say proudly, "I am a second-generation Bible student, a third-generation Bible student, a third, fourth-generation Bible student. I have the truth of the harvest message. The books are on the shelf in my bookcase. I am a consecrated son of God. I meet with an ecclesia of Bible students. I come to conventions in Phoenix and elsewhere." We must, likewise, individually, make that faith our own by continual study and living our faith daily, or else God's blessings will pass us by. I said before that the faith of the little maid in Elisha that he could cure Naaman's leprosy was remarkable, because Elisha had never before healed a leper. And just as we just read in Luke 4, Naaman was the first and only leper Elisha healed. So how could the little maid be so sure Elisha could do that? I think the answer is that the little maid most likely had seen or heard of Elisha's other miracles, and so it was on the basis of what she had seen that gave her the faith that Elisha could do what she had never seen him do. So it should be with us. Our faith in God's care over us is strengthened by all of his past favors and providences for ourselves and for others. And we trust him for all of our present and future care, even where we have not seen or cannot see what might come upon us. Such was the faith of the little maid. Such should our faith be. Now let's return to the end of the story of Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5. The last part of verse 19 says, "Naaman departed from Elisha a little way." Let's read verses 20-27. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, Behold, my master hath spared Naaman this Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought, the gold, the silver, the raiment. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him, Naaman, and take somewhat of him. So Gehazi followed after Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from his chariot to meet him and said, Is all well? And he said, All is well. My master hath sent me, saying, Behold, even now there be come to me from Mount Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and two changes of garments. And Naaman said, Be content, take two talents. And he urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments and laid them upon two of his servants, and they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand and bestowed or hid them, stowed them away in the house. And he let the men go back to Naaman, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said unto him, Whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, Thy servant went no whither. And he said unto him, Went not mine heart with thee, when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money, and to receive garments, and olive yards, and vineyards, and sheep, and oxen, and men servants, and maid servants? The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee, and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper, as white as snow. One of the details that caught my eye in this part of the account was in verse 21, where it says, Naaman lighted down or got off of his chariot to meet the running Gehazi, and asks urgently, Is everything okay? Is all well? Now, normally an important man like Naaman would wait, standing high and proud in his chariot, for the humble servant to approach and deliver the message he was sent with. But Naaman was humble and got down off his chariot, his high place, to meet the running Gehazi, concerned that the messenger was bringing bad news of some misfortune that had befallen Elisha and that he needed help. Could Naaman come back and help Elisha? He's in trouble. Humility and concern for the welfare of one with whom he had bonded in the worship of the true God was another good quality of Naaman's character. And so it should be with us. Gehazi, of course, did not have the spirit of Elisha, and he schemed to take advantage of Naaman's generous offer of payment, which Elisha had previously and firmly declined. Generous Naaman gives Gehazi even more than Gehazi requested, and even provides two of his servants to carry the silver and the clothes back for him. Gehazi hides the goods in the house and then goes into Elisha. And again, in the movie version of this scene that I picture in my mind, Elisha is sitting at his table, deep in thought, perhaps in prayer. And without even looking up, Elisha asks Gehazi, Where have you been? Nowhere. Reminds me of the conversations I often had with my kids when they were teenagers. Where did you go? Nowhere. What did you do? Nothing. Now Elisha looks up and fixes his gaze on the lying servant and tells Gehazi that Elisha knows exactly where he went and what he did. Elisha's rebuke in verse 26 is particularly relevant, I think, to us in our day. You notice Elisha said something rather strange. He said, Is it time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? Notice the very specific form and wording of the question. Is it time to receive all material gain? Brethren, the same question is put to us every day, not by someone speaking the question to us, but in our experiences in our daily lives. Is it time now to receive material gain? Is that where our efforts and attention should be focused? And we know that the answer is now is not the time for us to receive or desire material gain, but rather to sacrifice. There will be a time. The time will come at our spiritual birth when we will receive riches beyond our imagination. But that time is not yet. So let us touch lightly the things of this earth, as Elisha did, esteeming them only of trifling worth. Gehazi's punishment was that the leprosy from which Naaman was cleansed fell upon Gehazi and his house forever. This seems to be a picture of second death. But when should we apply it? To the willful sinners among the consecrated in the gospel age, or to the incorrigible of mankind in the kingdom? Now, Elisha's miracles in general are kingdom pictures, and that's how we have applied the healing of Naaman, to the kingdom. But there are also in this account many lessons, I think, for us now, and we have brought those out as we have discussed this passage. So I think the answer to the question about the second death in this story is that it applies primarily to the incorrigible of mankind in the kingdom. But I think there is also a secondary lesson about the possibility in the gospel age. And so the Bible account of the story of Naaman the leper, my favorite Bible story, ends. But again, in the movie version that keeps running through my mind, I need a happier ending. This last part about Gehazi is rather sad. I like happy endings. So, while the scriptures don't tell us what happened when Naaman got back to Damascus, maybe it ended like this. As Naaman approached the city, word quickly spread from the farmers in the outlying districts to the residents of Damascus that Naaman was on his way home and he was cured of his leprosy. As Naaman entered the gates of the city, a throng pressed forward to greet him and then parted so he could be received by his friend the king, who also joyously awaited Naaman's arrival. But the warmest greeting and embrace of all, I think, came from his wife, whose little maid had first told her of the prophet in Israel. And as for the little maid herself, I like to think that Naaman rewarded her, perhaps by returning her to her homeland of Israel. But even more so, I think, Naaman gave her freedom in Syria and riches, and even arranged for one of his sons to marry the little maid, so that Naaman's own grandchildren could be brought up in the worship of the true God. Well, we don't know how the story of Naaman the leper actually ended. Perhaps in the kingdom we will find out. But one thing we do know for sure is that today, in our time, the year 2016, somewhere beneath the busy paved streets of modern-day Damascus, lie two mules' burden of earth. Sacred soil, imported from Israel by one of Syria's greatest generals, who was a believer in Jehovah God, a picture of the kingdom work, and an example of faith. And so may God grant us all that faith, like Naaman's, and that of the little maid.